This episode contains graphic descriptions of real medical scenarios faced by real medical professionals. Listener discretion is advised. From Knowledgeable Provider, this is Critical Incident. Hello, welcome back to Critical Incident from Knowledgeable Provider. I have such a great story for you. Today we welcome our first guest contributor to Critical Incident onto the show. Dylan Kessler is a paramedic from Central Connecticut with 15 years of EMS experience. He started in EMS in 2009 as a volunteer when he was just 16 years old. By 2016, he was a licensed paramedic and had completed a bachelor's degree in EMS management. He worked as a firefighter paramedic for about 5 years after that. And for the last 2 years, he has worked exclusively as a paramedic for a third service. He is a licensed EMS instructor, as well as an instructor for both ACLS and PALS. He's also a member of a DMAT, that's Disaster Medical Assistance Team, through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Dylan Kessler, welcome to Knowledgeable Provider. Thanks so much for your time, man. I appreciate you doing this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I've already done your formal bio, I've already introduced you. So about 15 years in EMS at this point, right?
Yeah, I started really young. I was 16 when I started as a volunteer firefighter. It's kind of the only thing I've ever done.
We have that in common. I was in high school when I started doing the fire and EMS stuff too. I feel like we could do a whole separate episode just about that.
Yeah, it was great. One of the things I kind of feel passionately about now is I don't think children should be doing this job. It was a great place to start. And it was one of those times I really think like kind of pulling the ladder up behind us is important. There's other ways to, you know, foster this field without, you know, having children go on medical calls.
I've never really thought about it that way, but we were children, weren't we?
Yeah.
What age do you think would be appropriate for somebody to be start being exposed to all that?
You know, it's tough. Like this job, there's a lot of trauma that we take on as providers. You know, 18 is what we call a legal adult in this country. So I think at least there would be a good starting point.
We were out doing some very adult things when we were 16.
Yeah, it was great. I wouldn't be where I am now without it. But
yeah, I feel the same way. And but I do definitely remember like my friends were out doing teenage things and I was out, you know, doing ambulance things.
I was in the exact same boat.
It was weird. I remember days like sitting at lunch, being upset about the cardiac arrest I'd just run the night before, you know, like thinking these peas look like this puke that I just cleaned up. Now that you mention it, I guess that's really not a normal thing for a 16-year-old to be dealing with. Very interesting.
I look at 16-year-olds today and they look really young to me.
That's very true. Yeah. In the situation I'm in, I'm lucky if somebody that age even comes to see me by themselves.
Right.
We're getting 30-year-olds still with their parents, you know?
I believe it.
I never was a firefighter paramedic. I worked at a municipal, well, third service, you know, really my whole time in EMS. I got the feeling that most paramedics were trying to go the other way toward the firefighting side, but you went the opposite, right? You went from fire medic to just paramedic.
Yeah, I get that a lot. You know, I love being a firefighter. It's actually where I started. It was on a fire department. And I still feel passionately about firefighting. But the more time I spent as a fire medic, I realized that I could be a good firefighter or I could be a good paramedic. And I felt that splitting my time between both made it really hard to be good at either. We had a lot of new paramedics coming on as our department was growing. And since I had a little bit of seniority, I found myself spending more and more time on a ladder company. And I loved it, but I'd go, you know, 2-3 months without being on the ambulance. And I was really frustrated with that.
I admire that a lot. I feel like EMS is a great profession and just a fascinating thing. And I always gravitated that toward that more than the fire side. And you're all in. You're a professional. You have a degree. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's been a wild ride. I love it.
I feel like you're an excellent example or an excellent mentor for the field.
Oh, thank you. I've been trying to, you know, give back. I have been serving as a preceptor a bit at work. And actually, I had a student with me on this call we're about to discuss.
Yeah, let's get into it. This is the section of the podcast that's for storytelling. So I heard you have a good story to tell.
Yeah. So it was, call it 6 months ago. We had a batch of paramedic students coming through. And I think it was my first shift with this student. You know, 7:30 in the morning rolls around. He comes walking in, introduces himself. And, you know, he'd had time at other services already. So I asked him immediately, like, what have you done? What have you seen? What are you feeling comfortable with? just to kind of gauge his experience level as a paramedic student. He was like, I've done a fair number of pretty routine ALS calls. I haven't had a whole lot more than that, except I did do a crike 2 weeks ago. And I was like, tell me more about that.
No big deal.
Yeah, he was with the fire department, and they went and during a cardiac arrest, they discovered it had been a choking patient, and they had done a crike because the obstruction was too low into the trachea for them to get with McGill's. And the person didn't survive. Sounds like they were long in cardiac arrest by the time they were even found. But hearing him talk about that, I said, you know, we're not doing that today, but we can do everything else. And I live to eat those words. So it was, call it 8 o'clock at night or so. We were about finishing up our shift, and we got dispatched to our local mall for a person having a seizure. And we go on a lot of seizure calls. Probably at least 90% of them have resolved by the time we arrive on scene. So we arrive. There's a single engine company on scene. They've got four BLS providers with them, and we get law enforcement responding with us as well. This patient was in the passenger seat of a car parked in the handicap parking. So they are right in front of a very large mall right at the entrance. And my initial impression when we arrived on scene was, to be totally honest, it looked kind of BS to me. The person's kind of sitting upright in their car, and the seizure activity was pretty odd. Their right hand was just kind of like patting their stomach, and that was the only real movement that I could observe from the ambulance. My partner was a new EMT. He'd been an EMT for maybe 8 months, and we exited the ambulance, and the fire department immediately comes kind of running over to us. And the captain says that he had actually been on a call about a week before with the same patient who'd had a seizure at a different location in our town.
Okay.
And he said the other day shift paramedic that I work with had treated her. He'd used the entire NARC kit's worth of Versed and was unable to break the seizure when he transported her.
Wow. Okay.
So that's when things kind of started to feel a little bit more real.
Yeah.
My student got out. I grabbed the NARC kit. And our protocol is immediately to give 10 milligrams of IM Versed when we make contact with a patient who's still seizing. While he's doing that, our EMT was getting some demographic information, and the patient's family had, you know, a tremendous med list. The story we got was she is a lifelong epilepsy patient. She's been seizing since she was about 10. They were well-managed seizures until she had a baby about 6 or 8 months ago. Since having the baby, she's been having frequent seizures, and she's been working with a team of doctors trying to get it under control. So our student gave the 10 milligrams of Versed, and we lifted her onto the stretcher and moved to the ambulance. You know, I'm a big proponent of working in our office.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's dark too, so we get some more lighting that way. She was bariatric, and it was a little bit difficult getting her from the car to the stretcher because, you know, the shape of the car and getting her through the door frame was a little difficult.
How bariatric are we talking?
I think about 350.
Okay.
I'm kind of sizing up the patient as we're moving to the ambulance. We've already given Versed. And all I thought about was, like, she has a terrible Mallampati score.
Yeah.
You know, she has a tremendous neck and her head is right on her shoulders. So not a lot of airway to work with.
Yikes.
So we get her into the ambulance and grab our initial set of vitals. Everything looked pretty good. Her seizure kind of activity had stopped at this point, but she still had a like fixed leftward gaze. And so I had concern that she was still seizing. We got IV access in her, and my partner put an NPA in to try to work with getting some more oxygen in there. And shortly after putting in the NPA, we started getting some secretions coming from her mouth. And I directed the EMT to try to do his best to suction what he could. And he started and immediately kind of notified me that she had pretty significant trismus. So he's doing his best trying to get the Yankauer behind her teeth and making fairly little progress. One of the fire captain hopped in, and he was a city EMT for a long time before switching to fire. He starts trying to get her mouth open. I see him just like pulling on her jaw. I was like, you know, that's not going to work. Our protocol calls for 10 milligram IM Versed doses or 5 milligram IV. At this point, when we start getting the secretions, I just told the EMT student, you know, I'll figure out how to chart it later, but we're going to give the whole 10 milligrams IV because we need to get this airway open. So he does that. Shortly after he pushed the Versed, we started getting a pretty profound amount of emesis coming up. It was thick secretions, had a lot of food, partially, you know, chewed up food. And as this is happening, I look up at the monitor and her sat is just dropping and going fast.
Yikes.
She went from a 98 SpO2 to about 70 in under a minute.
Wow.
Our supervisor heard us on scene and heard kind of, I think that maybe, I don't know, elevated voices from the fire department. Something triggered him that he drove over. So we kind of did a quick make sure everybody agrees that our next and only option at this point is Craig. We don't have RSI capabilities.
Okay.
Everybody agreed. While I was grabbing the kit, the paramedic student actually had a Sharpie and he landmarked it for us like super well. I guess it helps, you know, having done two of them now.
Yeah, perfect.
The supervisor opened the back doors right as I was holding the scalpel. And he's like, what's going on? What am I walking into? Like, time out for a second. And I just kind of pointed at the monitor and her sat was about 70. And he was like, yeah, do your thing. So I made a first vertical incision. We had kind of an expected amount of blood and no visualization of landmarks at all. Just all adipose. So I made a second incision over top of that one. So, you know, hopefully the same surgical plane, made a deeper incision and was able to, from there, kind of landmark everything that we needed to see. I could see mostly the cartilage. I wasn't able to see the membrane at that point. I used my finger to landmark the membrane and breach the membrane with the scalpel with my finger in there. As soon as I breached the membrane, we oxygen sat, went right up back into the 90s. My brand new EMT partner bagged her while I was doing this and, you know, blew blood all over me. I was like, yeah, a little warning would have been nice, but he didn't know any better. We had from there, you know, bought ourselves a little bit of time. We're oxygenating again. And so we have 6-0 trach tubes that are part of the North American Rescue kit. And passing that tube was very difficult. I think took maybe 2 or 3 attempts to pass that tube. I think we were winding up kind of between the skin and the membrane instead of going into the trachea. What wound up working best was we took the suction and applied the suction kind of wide open onto the surgical site while I held it open. And then my paramedic supervisor was able to then visualize the rest of the membrane and pass that tube through.
Wow.
So it was kind of multiple hand operation just to keep all of that adipose out of the trachea.
This is a movie situation now. We're in like you never see this territory.
Right. And then, you know, her family's there too. So we have another level of stress. There's, you know, spouse and kids, and we're in a mall parking lot. And there was still some pretty heavy bleeding going on. Not life-threatening, but like concerning bleeding. So we have quick clot infused bandages. We just wrap some of that around the tube and like time to go. It's time to transport. Like we're not doing anything more for this patient. Oh, actually, after we made the second incision and were attempting to pass the tube, she actually had purposeful movement and reached up and tried to push us away.
Bad timing. We needed you to do that a few minutes ago.
Yeah, really bad timing. It really kind of left us in this questioning moment of, you know, she's no longer seizing if she has purposeful movement. Do we then abort this and just try to tube her or continue to pass the tube? I kind of was like, you know, we're committed. We've already cut her neck open. We are committed to this fully. And my supervisor actually administered some ketamine for restraint. And I learned subsequently, our medical director was explaining that ketamine is actually pretty good as an anti-convulsant as well. So that probably helped in addition to the restraint. So yeah, we secured the tube. We transported to the hospital. We notified them. It was about an 8-minute ride to the hospital from there. They have an app that we notify them through. And I basically wrote like the quickest note in there. I was like, you know, we did a surgical crag for status app and we'll be there in 5, vitals are stable. The hospital, when we get there, had not assigned us to a critical care or trauma room. They just assigned us to a regular bed. I was a bit confused. They were like, well, this isn't a trauma patient. I'm like, well, she wasn't initially.
She has a hole in her neck now. Does that count?
Right. Like, wow. She does have trauma. There, you know, they did have all the adequate resources there. The trauma surgeon was pretty happy with us.
Sweet. That's always a nice feeling.
Yeah, he was saying, you know, he trained a lot of paramedics on crags during his military service. And he told us he thought it was an underutilized tool in EMS. And from there, she had a really good outcome. So they took her up to the OR. They repaired the crag that we had done. And they also did a bronchoscope on her. And she had aspirated a significant amount of food during this. And they were able to kind of clean everything out. She had a 4-day hospital stay after that and was discharged home.
You saved her life, man.
Yeah. So it was kind of a wild ride, really stressful. We talk a lot about stress-induced time warp, where minutes feel like hours, hours feel like minutes. And that call, it felt like we were doing this crag for at least an hour back there.
I bet.
It made me realize that, you know, the EMS training I'd had on surgical airways was not adequate. The paramedic program I had attended only trained us on the Quick Drake product, which is the needle. That was, at the time, the state's only option for crags. They've added surgical now as the preferred route. And we'd had some training. They brought in instructors and mannequins. But I don't think that doing it one time on a mannequin adequately prepared me for this.
So at this point, you had not done this procedure on a patient ever?
Never.
This was your first time?
Yeah.
How long had it been since you were trained on it?
It's been just over a year.
Okay.
And of course, during the training, you know, they're all, you're never going to actually do this. And if you do actually do this, it's going to be on somebody who's dead anyway.
That's probably not the right way to present that.
Yeah. And, you know, I think this is the first one that's ever been done at my service. So everybody was kind of in that mindset of like, oh, this will never happen to me. So, I, you know, things changed. Under a month after that, we did have our medical director come in to do more crag training with us.
Fantastic.
He showed us pictures that he had from some crags that were done in the hospital he works at, some better, some worse. And we kind of changing up the equipment we carry. When I got to the hospital with the patient, the first thing they asked me was like, what size tube did you use? Like, I don't know, the one that was in the kit. What size scalpel did you use? I don't know, it was the one that was in the kit. Our medical director had kind of recommended just switching over to using endotracheal tubes for these. He thought it was, you know, something we already carry and something that we're already, you know, familiar with, and it'll be a little bit easier to place. And then be probably less likely to be dislodged during transport.
That's really cool, man. Other than the student that was there, had anyone else ever done one of those of the people who were on scene there?
No, nobody had. You know, we swung by the fire department the next day with some donuts because they were pretty helpful.
Nice.
All the guys were still talking about it when we got there. They're, you know, saying they didn't even think that was something paramedics did, let alone think they'd be seeing one.
When we would get a new skill, which didn't happen very often, you know, there was always like this race to do it. Like, who's going to be the first person to get to do whatever? Was that going through your mind in the moment? Were you like, I'm the first person ever to do this?
To be honest, not really. We talk about that all the time. We just got a new drug and everyone's talking about who's going to be the first one to use it. And that wasn't going through my head. To be honest, I was kind of just terrified.
I bet.
You know, I care about my patients. I don't want something bad to happen to them. And this is happening in front of their kids. This is happening in front of family. And they've got a newborn at home. Like, I was just terrified.
That's good of you to admit that. I know I would have been. Jeez.
It was. And, you know, I'm completely relieved at the outcome. I actually visited the patient in the hospital after. She was thrilled. You know, lawsuit was going through my head right off the bat. Like, did we do everything right prior to this crag?
Yeah.
Did we do the crag right? Did, you know, I didn't have sterile gloves on. I just had EMS gloves. Like, is she going to get some, you know, severe infection from having my finger there? We used the the suction to suction out the blood out of the surgical site. Like, I was pretty worried about, the potential outcome. And then, of course, lawsuit goes with that. But she was thrilled and couldn't have been happier with the outcome and, really appreciated it.
What a great story, man. That is fantastic.
I appreciate that.
So now your paramedic student's going to be running around thinking he's going to crack someone every 10 days or something.
His paramedic class, as a graduating gift, they got him a some sort of custom knife. Yeah, I think they were calling him scalpel.
Other than what you've already mentioned, was there anything else that made it extra stressful for you?
I think having a student with me was more stressful than if I had been doing it without the student. Being in my routine with my partner, he was new EMT, but like I worked exclusively with him for at least 6 months at that point. I feel like we kind of had a way that we just knew what the other person needed. And having that paramedic student kind of just threw off the cadence of the call a little bit. I know when my supervisor opened that door, the back door, to check on what was going on, he said the paramedic student was just kind of like barking orders at people. I don't even remember it, but because I was just tuning him out.
Sure. I guess at that point, he was probably the most experienced at that one procedure. That's a weird flipping of the dynamic also.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he's had training more recently than me. He's done one before, or at least been part of doing one before. And so I did want to rely on him as a resource. And I'm happy to admit that. Like, if somebody's better at something than me, like, I'm going to utilize that. Having him help me landmark, having him kind of just hand me supplies was really helpful.
That's not a skill that I ever learned that we ever had available here. As far as I know, they still don't, at least not on the ground. I've watched a surgeon do that, but other than that, I don't know anything about it. In case anyone else is not familiar, would you mind just going through the procedure and describing the whole thing? I mean, in an ideal situation?
Yeah, sure. Again, my training's kind of limited too. But the few take homes that I've taken from the training and from doing it is, we always want to start with that vertical incision. Our protocol allows for vertical and horizontal. I believe the way it's worded is that we make a 2-inch vertical incision over the cricothyroid membrane. And if we're unable to make any visualization of our landmarks, we're supposed to make a horizontal incision. I didn't need to do that. And when I got to the hospital, the trauma surgeon was really appreciative. He said he much appreciated that it was a vertical incision only. After making that 2-inch incision over the cricothyroid membrane in a male with a small neck and a profound Adam's apple, it's a lot easier to landmark. So, of course, our training mannequins are always that.
Right.
You can visualize the membrane, and it's on a mannequin, it's a lot easier to do. You can see that membrane is kind of just very, very thin and silver, but when doing it on a real person, it was just so, there was so much blood that it was pretty hard to do. We were trained that we're supposed to rupture that membrane with the scalpel and then immediately kind of put our finger in that hole to maintain our place. Some places are encouraging the use of bougies at that point. So you stick a bougie in there and then can use that to kind of guide your tube. But it's really easy once you breach that membrane to lose it, because the trachea can move inside the neck. And so you don't want that trachea to move outside of your kind of surgical site through the skin. And from there, it's kind of standard tube care. We want to get end tidal on there, confirm breath sounds. The other thing they talked about that's kind of a valuable tool for the toolbox is once you breach that membrane, sometimes you'll see paramedics providers, they'll flip the scalpel over and they'll just stick the scalpel handle in the trachea. It's already been in the surgical site. It was sterile when it came out the packaging, and it can be a pretty good placeholder. It's already in your hand. You don't have to go grab a bougie. You don't have to grab anything else.
I guess the downside would just be the blade sticking up in the area.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully you've locked it out first.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. Gotcha.
With mine, it took a few attempts to get that tube through. So I was really glad I hadn't locked out the scalpel at that point. We actually, once we were suctioning and attempting to get that tube in place, we found there was quite a bit more of the membrane that hadn't been breached. And my partner or my supervisor actually cleared the rest of that membrane to buy us a little bit more space.
How much space is that? I've always thought of that as a very small opening. But it's big enough to stick your finger in?
Yeah, I guess it's you know, person dependent. Our ladies, I would say the membrane was the size of a quarter.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I know when our medical director came in for our training, he had us all take a pen and mark everybody else's in the room. And he did mine first to kind of demonstrate. And he had remarked that I have a very small membrane. He was like, you would be a disaster to try to crack.
I have nothing to compare it to, but I feel like mine is small too. Because when I was trained to do needle crikes only, and I never actually have done one. But, you know, just trying to imagine that on myself, I'm always like, that's not a very big, like, I guess I could get a 14 in there. But it doesn't feel much bigger than that.
Yeah, they're tiny. You know, needle crikes are interesting. I have a really good friend who's also a paramedic, and he's done a few crikes. Their service carried initially the needle quick crike as their first line, and they did have scalpel as like a second line if they failed with the needle. And after their service had done a few of the needle crikes, they had failed almost all of them. It's really, really hard to breach through the membrane and get that needle in place. I think a lot of times people actually wind up going through the trachea.
Okay, yeah.
And so they wound up just taping a scalpel to all of their needles, to like the kit that it comes in, just because so often they're having to go to the scalpel.
Yeah, I feel like I remember watching a video of they would put a camera inside the trachea and then have somebody do the needle crike. And I feel like I remember them saying, you know, it's very hard to get it in there without punching the opposite wall.
We do have, like, it's not a commercially made needle crike kit in our ambulances, but they do have like all of the components you would need set up with our crike kits. But our training is to go to the scalpel first line.
It sounds like it all worked out perfectly. It sounds like you guys did an amazing job.
Thank you.
So the one time I experienced something like that, I was doing a rotation as a student with the trauma service. I was with a trauma surgeon in the OR who was trying to put in a regular tracheostomy. It was a bariatric patient, and this was a trauma surgeon, you know, and he was struggling, and he was like cussing himself and, you know, struggling to get this airway in. And it was terrifying for me just standing there watching. I can't imagine, number one, having never done it before. And then number two, in this not great situation, man, I'm getting chills just thinking about it, just imagining it.
Yeah. I have a family friend who's an ear, nose, and throat surgeon. And I texted him about it. And I was like, you know, I'm kind of beating myself up. It took me, you know, it took us two or three tries to get this tube in. And he was like, man, in the OR, it takes us 7 tries on some patients. Like, it's not unheard of for it to be really hard.
Even for a surgeon who's, you know, really trained to do it.
Yeah, they've done them before.
Yeah. Gosh, that's amazing, man. I can't even imagine. Any takeaway points? Anything you would pass along to anybody else that finds themselves in that situation?
Yeah, I think for, you know, paramedics out there, it shows the importance of training on those HALO procedures, the high acuity, low occurrence. We don't do it enough. We need to be, because, you know, you could find yourself in my shoes where 10 minutes before end of shift, now you're having to make this decision in a mall parking lot. We don't rise to the occasion. We fall to our level of training.
Love that.
So I think getting repetitions in doing this skill, even if it's on a mannequin, something's better than nothing.
Yeah, great advice. You know, when they started saying, oh, we shouldn't let paramedics intubate because blah, blah, blah. I don't know if that discussion is still going on, but several years ago, there was this moment where they were like, is this a good idea? And I always thought, well, you know what? If we're not good at intubating, you need to train us better. You don't need to take the skill away.
Yeah, I really agree with that. We're seeing that here too a little bit. You know, eye gels have really kind of started to dominate the supraglottic airway market, and they are great. But because of that, there's been some of that feedback of, you know, paramedics can successfully place eye gels 97% of the time first try. Why are we letting them intubate with, you know, 70% success rates? And it is frustrating. I you know, we do 6 to 10 intubations a year, if we're lucky, for lack of a better term. And outside of paramedic school, we don't get to go back to the OR and practice doing them. And we're starting to see here in Connecticut, they're allowing more providers to RSI. I think in my county, there's only one service that's doing it, but there's a few services in the state that are now. And so I'm hoping that's a sign that we're starting to go back the other way, train on airway, routinely practice airway management, and then be comfortable to aggressively manage that airway that needs to be managed.
Yeah, absolutely. Because when that 6 times a year, when that does come around, you don't need to be screwing around. Somebody really needs you in that moment.
Exactly. And, you know, video scopes have gotten so cheap that most ambulances do have them. We have the tools to be successful in this. And it would have saved me from having to do this procedure.
I remember sometimes, you know, the first time you ever do something, you train on it, you think about it, you study it, and you learn it. But then suddenly you're in that moment and you're like, shit, I'm about to have to actually do this. It is terrifying and it shouldn't be. It should be second nature, just like you know, bag somebody or whatever.
Right. We don't think twice about doing our IVs. We've all done 9,000 IVs. I could assemble my IV kit blindfolded.
That's what you need for airway. You know, who cares if you get an IV? I need that kind of confidence to get somebody's airway.
Right. And it's not being done enough.
My first full-time partner on the ambulance made it all the way through paramedic school and never intubated a live person.
How's that possible?
How is that even possible?
Yeah. And, you know, I don't think it's required anymore. The National Registry has a skills packet that they have to have documented of each skill, but doing that skill on a mannequin counts towards their total number. So I'm not sure if they still require actual live intubations or not.
That's doing a disservice to the providers and the patients.
I agree.
Because it's not the same.
Yeah, I know paramedics that, you know, went back in the day when things were like, it has to be 100% done on live patients. You need to use electricity on a live patient. You need to do intubations on live patients. And one of the paramedics I know, I think he rode like an extra 800 hours or something trying to get a tube.
Wow.
He said it was like an extra 6 months that he was just picking up ride time shifts trying to get one more tube.
Wow. It's admirable. That sucks for him. But I mean, that's really kind of good, I guess.
He said by the end, it was just like any call that sounded like it needed airway management, they were just driving him around in a fly car too. And
sure. Well, anything else you want to share? Anything else that came to mind?
I think that's it. I had some notes written down here and I think we got them all. Do you have any other questions for me?
No, not at all. I really appreciate your time. Dylan Kessler, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I would love to share your critical incident on the podcast. If you have a story you want to tell, send it to me by email at thekppod@gmail.com. That's thekppod@gmail.com. You can send it in writing and I'll read the story. You can make a high quality recording of yourself telling the story and I'll play that. Or I can interview you about it, either remotely or in person. Thank you for listening. And as always, stay safe, take care of yourself, and take care of your patients in that order.
I hope I didn't talk too fast. Us Northerners talk pretty quick sometimes.
No, I think you're good.
Awesome.